It was a bit of a head-scratcher. To the untrained eye, it was just a patch of green seaweed on the reef. But researchers determined it was, in fact, a type of mudweed not ever seen in our backyard before. Turns out this invasive new species may be difficult to remove from our reefs because it can be found in deep water. So the standby solutions of community cleanups or using the super sucker machine to clear the reef of the invaders may not do the trick. We sat down with researcher Rachel Wade to talk about why scientists are watching this green seaweed closely and why they need the public's help.
So just first and foremost, I want to emphasize that this was only found by accident. This was not found in an effort to look for something new. This was found during a dive for fun by a diver who knows his seaweed really well. And then during a regular seagrass survey by the Division of Aquatic Resources. And luckily, again, they had a trained seaweed specialist with them who immediately recognized that this was new and different. So this was not part of a management effort or a research effort. It was really found by accident. Just sort of anecdotally, some of the people that were on that survey, that seagrass survey, didn't notice it. And it was that person, Dr. Kim Payton, who works for the Division of Aquatic Resources, who worked on the other species that we've had here since the 80s, Avernvillea amidelpha, for her dissertation. If she had not been there, they probably would have overlooked it. One was found more seaward of Pearl Harbor, and the other was found within Honolulu Harbor. And then the one that's been here since the 80s, it's been here for a little over 30 years, that one is found almost entirely around the island of Oahu. Also, my research has shown that it has spread to Kauai and Maui.
So what's so bad about this seaweed?
So we're not sure about the new one because we just found it and there hasn't been any work done to see if it's affecting our native species and native environments. But we are concerned because of the threat that is posed by the previous species that's identified as Avernvillea amidelpha. That species has been found to displace native species, so native seagrasses and other species of algae that grow in sandy environments in particular, but also those that live on rocky benches and things like that. It's also concerning because it really changes the bottom of the marine environment. So they have these really large root-like structures that collect sand and sediment. And because of that buildup of sediment, they can essentially smother other organisms like corals living on those shared surfaces. And so because of that threat, we are concerned and want to keep an eye on this new one, because we're just not sure if it's going to behave in a similar way.
So when was this found? Just this summer?
One was found last summer in 2017. That was the one that was found offshore of Kaiehi Harbor and Pearl Harbor. And then the other that was found by Dr. Payton and her team with the Division of Aquatic Resources was found in 2015. It took us a while to get a confident identification on it. So this group is very challenging, and that's because it can really change how it looks depending on where it's growing and what the environment looks like. So it took us quite a while to come up with a really confident identification.
Is this type of seaweed easily cleaned off the reef?
It's going to be challenging for a couple of reasons. So first and foremost, the population that we found in 2017 was deep. So it makes those community efforts very challenging. When you're looking at 25 meters or about 75 feet, that makes it a lot challenging to have community engagement, which is so important with this kind of thing. The other thing that's really difficult with both of these species is that because of that root-like structure, they anchor themselves very well, and so it's difficult to pull them off the reef, and it's difficult to pull them off entirely. And the thing about these species is that they can actually grow back from very small fragments. So if you're not able to remove the entire alga, the entire seaweed individual, it can grow back.
So the super sucker is not then very reliable to use?
I would say no. My understanding of the success of the super sucker was because in a lot of ways, the species that were in Kaneohe Bay that it was used for were sort of floating mats that could easily be grabbed and sucked up, whereas this is really anchored.
Wow. So what are we going to do?
It's a really great question. I unfortunately don't have a suggestion. I mean, the one suggestion I can make is that all of us as people who go to the beach, as divers, as fishers, as community members, we all keep track of it. We don't know if this is going to behave the same way as the first species that got introduced. And the best way we can sort of begin to look at if there are going to be negative impacts is to keep track of how well it's doing here and therefore how much it's spreading.
So you're going to need to rely on folks who are either members of Eyes of the Reef or just folks out there who can report this stuff?
I think so. I think they're our most powerful resource.
So where did this stuff come from?
We're not sure. That's a great question. In our paper, we speculated a little bit about where it possibly could have come from. The species Avrombilia erecta is known to be fairly common throughout the Pacific. So it could have come in from Australia, Japan, China, the Philippines. Those are all common areas where there are known populations of this species. And it could have come in because it's near major ports. It could have come in on boats. But also, there's been a lot of work done showing that there was a huge introduction of species as a result of the tsunami off the west coast of Japan, or I'm sorry, the east coast of Japan. And it's also possible that it was introduced somewhat naturally through, you know, increased water influx and hitchhikers of debris that were carried from the western Pacific to the eastern Pacific.
So they might have just been like hitchhikers on some marine debris that blew in.
Right. As we've seen skiffs and things like that show up from Japan, it could easily have been attached to something like that or a boat. It's very difficult to speculate on how it got here. But the fact that it is so close to harbors does suggest that it could have come in on some sort of vessel.
Okay, so what's the word that you folks are trying to get out to the public?
We mostly just want people to be aware so that they can be our eyes.
Just trying to think if there's anything else. It's really found in deep water and not very easy to eradicate.
And it is found in shallow, too. So the site that's closer or within Honolulu Harbor, that site was much more shallow. That was 12 to 15 meters, so that's more like 50 feet. I mean, still pretty deep for, you know, beachgoers, you know, that are just enjoying the shallow area, but a little bit more shallow, but not as accessible by any means as like Mauna Loa Bay or something like that, where you can sort of almost wade in.
So again, describe what the newcomer looks like.
So the one we've had here for years is going to have multiple paddle-shaped blades per plant, and it's going to be brownish, grayish in color, and it may be on rock, and it may be in sand. The newcomer is bright green, with one single blade that's often quite kidney bean or fan shaped, and you're going to see single individuals instead of sort of clumps of individuals, and just really very bright green and kidney bean shaped. That's the best way to describe it.
That was doctoral student Rachel Wade, who is working on this new group of green algae for her dissertation at the University of Hawaii Manoa campus. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In our backyard today, we're climbing 13,796 feet above sea level to take a closer look at the universe, right up to the summit of Mauna Kea. At this altitude, we've got about 40% of the atmosphere below us, and the stars are a lot clearer at night. Of course, the atmosphere is a lot thinner, too, and it's difficult to breathe up here, especially if you're used to hanging around the beach at the shoreline bottom of our thick, dense ocean of air. That's why they have that visitor center on the way up. It is highly recommended that you stop there and get acclimatized before driving up to the summit. Oh, and bring a jacket, too. In the tropics, you lose about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit for every 1,000 feet of elevation. So at close to 14,000 feet, we're talking nearly 50 degrees colder. So if it's 80 down in Kona, it might be in the 30s at the summit, which is where we'll find the Keck telescopes. Each of the two Keck telescopes has a 36-segment, 10-meter-wide mirror to focus. It's the largest in the world, so all you astronomers for a night can't wait to get a look through those Keck telescope eyepieces and see the stars up close, can you? Well, actually, no, you can't. Even if the nice astronomers in charge of Keck wish you could and want you to, you just can't. Can you tell us why not? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Honolulu Magazine. The December issue features the annual Best Lawyers in Hawaii list. More information online at honolulumagazine.com.
Time for an intervention. Well, we continue our look at what's happening with our coral reefs. A new report by the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine says current efforts to manage stressors may not be enough. Bob Richmond, director of the Kiwala Marine Lab at the University of Hawaii and co-author of the study, talks about why there's this growing sense of urgency.
The result was a pretty extensive report, close to 200 pages, that identified 18 different kinds of interventions across four broad categories. Some of which are kind of ready to go. Others are going to have a ways before we feel comfortable with them. Some are pretty far out there. Others are things that people will probably feel comfortable with. But the idea was to be pretty inclusive of all options on the table. And interestingly enough, part of the guidance when they commissioned this effort was not to put cost into the equation. And the reason for that on the science side was the fact that things like gene sequencing that, you know, even 5 years ago was costing hundreds of thousands of dollars or more, is down to a couple thousand dollars. So they're taking into account that technologies are changing and along with it, so are costs. So they asked us to be as creative as we could to be able to examine all options on the table and kind of, in to misquote the movie The Martian, to science the heck out of it to find out what we can do.
So there are short-term and long-term fixes, I guess. What are the short-term things we can do?
Yeah, so again, part of the guidance was we all recognize that, you know, step number one is we've got to reduce stressors. So that's understood. The issue is that even if we were to stop the stressors today, and, you know, one of the examples I give is that, you know, giving up cigarette smoking is a good thing, but if you've got lung cancer already, that's not enough. And so if we were to just stop the decline today and kind of have the goal of leaving coral reefs in their present state as a legacy for the future, I and many of my colleagues would argue that we failed as a society. So the issue is not only how do we stop the continued decline, but how do we restore as much as we can of what's already been lost? So in the categories, we've examined everything from genetic and reproductive interventions. What can we do some of the wonderful work that, for example, Ruth Gates was doing until she unfortunately passed away recently, was on the cutting edge of managed selection to try to breed for corals that have certain characteristics such as resistance to temperature in response to climate change. That's one end of it, and people are quite comfortable with the ideas of managed selection. That's been going on for thousands of years in agriculture. You take characteristics of different strains of plants like corn, and then you select for ones that grow well under various conditions. The other way of approaching it is to not make new ones, but rather look for what's already out there. And Hawaii is interesting. We have a number of the typical stressors at the local level, sedimentation, runoff, coastal pollution, overfishing that leads to overgrowth with algae, especially in a world of nutrients. But we had a very unique one here. Some may remember the molasses spill we had in Honolulu Harbor. And so for many of us, that was a unique way of killing corals. I never had any idea that there actually were pretty excellent coral reefs in Honolulu Harbor. One would expect that no self-respecting coral would live there, but there were corals that were thriving.
That was so interesting that you folks were able to find out that even in a degraded environment, what we thought was a degraded environment, that these corals were thriving.
It was kind of a surprise and a shocker to us as well. Several of my graduate students were the first ones that were able to get on the scene when William Isla, then the chair of the Department of Land and Natural Resources, contacted us and asked for help. And we have videos of, you know, what were extensive reefs there, far beyond anything we would have thought. And so it was interesting. Part of the argument on behalf of what happened with the spill was, well, these are harbor corals and they don't really matter. And it was quite the opposite. These corals living in the harbor, when you think about it, they're exposed to just about every stressor that you can think of. Heavy metals from anti-fouling paints at the bottom of ships, oil spills, major temperature changes, a lot of urban runoff every time it rains. And yet there were corals in there that were thriving. So, you know, one idea is to try to select for super corals, and that is to selectively breed, take a coral that's doing really well against temperature, and see if you could cross that with a coral that's very good against, say, sediment or other pollutants. The other way is to go to these marginal areas like Honolulu Harbor and pick up the corals that have already gone through all of the selection and then see if you can work with them as the stock material to go forward. So in the genetic and reproductive interventions, it's everything from the managed selection to managed breeding. One idea was to take a look at collecting egg and sperm during these spawning events and to try to enhance the number of larvae you can produce. There's some interesting work going on actually at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology on coral cryopreservation, being able to freeze sperm, and that would enable you to do crosses from much greater distances. You might be able to take sperm from a coral from American Samoa in the tidal pools there and cross it with eggs from a coral from Guam or Palau that was extremely good against changes in ocean acidification. Once again, it's not a matter of should you do these things yet, but rather what are all the options that are out there.
Now, when I last saw you, we were listening to Professor Jennifer Doudna talk about gene editing, and we had a discussion about, gosh, what could we do with coral?
Oh, absolutely. And so the idea of CRISPR-Cas9, which has again been in the news recently, is the fact that you first need to identify what the genes are that you're looking for and what those genes do before you can even decide if you want to make a designer coral, if you want to be able to do some gene editing. So again, that's one of the issues that was on the table under genetic manipulation. The fact is that CRISPR-Cas9 is an effective system, and that's where you begin to get into the issues then of ethics, how comfortable do people feel. Certain things, there's a category called physiological interventions. And one thing that people have found, some work on exposure to elevated temperatures tied to climate change, is that if you raise the temperature of corals initially for a very short period and drop it down again, they're actually more resistant to the next time the temperatures come up. So it's called a pre-exposure. In other cases, because corals have a relationship with single cells of algae that live inside, it's not just the animal part of the coral, but it's their plant symbionts, that you may be able to change those to those that are a little bit more resistant to temperature. There's even things like antibiotics. Corals have disease, and in the Caribbean, it's been really devastating in areas of Florida and other parts of the Caribbean where coral disease has wiped out a fair amount of reef area. Are there antibiotics that can be used, or even things like phage therapy to control the bacteria that are tied to these diseases? And then there's a number of things that could be done at the environmental level in terms of, like, again, climate change. Can you find ways of cooling the water down rather than work on the biological side, work on those physical things that are beginning to cause corals to bleach at larger levels? So it was a really interesting committee to be on. There's a total of 12 people, 10 from the United States and 2 from Australia, and each one of us has a degree of expertise in some specific areas, but more broad experience of trying to work back and forth. There was a lot of input from managers, too, to understand what their willingness is to be able to try different things. And in a place like Florida, there's areas in Biscayne Bay, which is one of the national monuments, where the good reefs are at 3% coral cover. The bad reefs are at 0.05% coral cover. And when I was first told those numbers, I said, oh, somebody made a mistake in this place, the decimal point. And it was, no, it's for real. So when you're at that level, you know, there's not a whole lot you can do that's wrong. And I think the main consensus coming away from this is that inaction is the absolute wrong action.
Right.
Moving forward, then, it's looking at all these different interventions that are out there and then beginning to select those that could have the greatest positive impact in the short term, and those we still need to do more work before we can take a look at a longer-term fix.
So we need to intervene now because you say we're running out of time.
Absolutely. And once again, it's one of those situations where, you know, initially when I started working on coral reefs back in the 1970s, 1974, so 44 years ago, you know, I had the luxury of being able to see Caribbean reefs that were at 70 to 80% coral cover. I went back and visited some of my study reefs that I studied in the 1970s, and they were now down from 70 to 80% coral cover to between 2 and 5% coral cover. I never would have expected that in my professional career to see such an incredible loss. So the reality is that it's not only the spatial area that's being lost, but the rate at which we're seeing these losses as well, which means we really need to step up. And as I mentioned, you know, just stopping the rate of decline is insufficient. We really need to look at how we're going to turn things around and begin to restore genetic diversity, restore species, coral cover, habitat. And so there's quite a challenge there. But, you know, in the midst of all of the doom and gloom that we talk about, and again, with, you know, full, you know, nodding to Ruth Gates and her passion, is the agreement for a lot of us that we understand the coral reefs are severely threatened, but they're not doomed. And I think that's an important message that came out as well, is that there are a lot of things that we could be doing and should be doing, and that it's really up to us to ensure that there's a legacy of reefs for the future.
Dr. Bob Richmond is a director of the Kewalo Marine Laboratory for the University of Hawaii at Manoa and co-author of that study. And again, he does believe while our reefs are threatened, they are not doomed.
It makes so much sense. It's good for the station because it allows the station to have some idea of planned income coming in from a group of people. It's very convenient for me because essentially I've pressed the button, put it on electronic funds transfer, and I just select the level of membership, and it's easy and convenient, and I know that it works both ways. So I would recommend it to anybody who wants to support public radio. My name is Phil Kennicott, and I am extremely proud to be a sustaining member of Hawaii Public Radio.
There are rules, you know, for how noisy your workplace can be.
The standards are usually measured around, like, construction sites. We think of things like mechanic shops, factories.
Maybe you ought to add restaurants. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Louder eateries are more profitable. I'll tell you more next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, right after All Things Considered.
Our reality check this morning with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Today we get the latest twist on a story involving a young man on a train. Brittany Light joins us with the latest. Hi, Brittany.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Catherine.
So refresh the memory of our listeners about this story.
Yes. Yeah, so I have sort of a second update to a story that began on May 15th when Aaron Salazar, a 22-year-old Kaiser grad, was traveling by train on the mainland. He was on an overnight Amtrak train and went missing from the train. Police later found him unconscious and critically bleeding on the side of the railroad in California. Salazar was in a coma for 2 weeks, and during that time, Amtrak police came out. They were working on an investigation, and they held a press conference saying that there's no evidence that this young man was the victim of a fight. There's no evidence that there was an altercation. They said what they've found indicates that he may have attempted to jump off the train in an attempted suicide. Now, his family for months has been disputing this. They can't understand how Aaron, who is, you know, a very bubbly, happy young man, would ever do this to himself. And so finally now, Aaron is recovering to the point where he's actually able to speak, and his family has released a video on social media of him in his own words saying that he would never try to kill himself, that he did not jump out of the train. So basically, it's the next step here. He himself is able to use his own voice and sort of dispute what police are saying they believe happened to him.
Yeah, I saw that video, and it's just, it's very sad. I mean, it's great that he's recovering, but it's sad because you know that it is a long road to recovery. And I think there in Colorado where he's at, I think they've got some top flight facilities there that teach or that help to help folks to recover from brain injuries, I guess.
They do. He's at Craig, which is a rehabilitation hospital. He's actually home now, but he's getting speech therapy and physical therapy from them 3 times a week. And when I say home, he's in his family's new home. They moved from Hawaii to be with him there, where they thought he would get the best care. So he's doing better. He's recovering day by day, but there's you know, it's unclear how far his recovery will be able to go. You know, you listen to the video and you hear his voice and, you know that he didn't sound like that before the accident. He sounds robotic and it's, you know, almost a little bit difficult to make out what he's saying. So while it's a great improvement for him, it is sad because, you know, he has this brain injury and right now he can't even walk without any kind of an aid.
What can you tell us about the investigation, though?
So the Amtrak says that the investigation is ongoing, and they have said all along that, you know, they welcome the opportunity to interview Aaron if he's, you know, ever able to be interviewed. And so now he is, and the family has contacted them, and Amtrak says, you know, they would like to interview them, although to my knowledge, that hasn't actually happened yet. The FBI has also stepped in September, a couple of days after we reported on the family's doubts about Amtrak police, about their conclusion of what they believe happened to Aaron. The FBI stepped in, according to the family. Now, the FBI won't confirm or deny this, but the family says that an agent did visit Aaron in the hospital and took a DNA sample. They're taking that as an indication that perhaps the FBI is trying to vet and see if there's any DNA that was on Aaron's clothes during the time that perhaps came from an attacker.
I recall in one of your earlier stories, you had mentioned, I think, that he had texted a friend or a relative, I think, to say that he had met a friend and they were maybe going to go explore, you know, one of the stops along the train route.
Yeah, so the family believes that Aaron could have been the victim of a hate crime. For one, Aaron is gay. They think that that perhaps made him vulnerable. He's very friendly and outgoing. And right before he disappeared from the train, he had texted a relative and said that he had made a friend and they had plans to get off the train at the next stop when they had quite a long layover, excuse me, and to get lunch together. And the family hasn't been able to identify this person. They, you know, have a theory that perhaps this person wasn't a friend and had more sinister, you know, motives in terms of his their befriending of Aaron. So that is why the family thinks he could have been the victim of some sort of an attack, some sort of a hate crime. That's their theory.
Okay, well, I'll have to see what happens. But thank you, Brittany.
You're welcome.
That was Brittany Light with today's reality check. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org. Hawaii is a world leader in the science of astronomy, and this month, Hawaii's leading observatory is getting a new head scientist. Astronomer and physicist John O'Meara has just started his new job as chief scientist at the Keck Observatory. But as HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us, his new role will entail more than just science.
Well, the role of the chief scientist is to be sort of the public face and public voice of science at the observatory, and also to be an important interface between lots of different stakeholders in the observatory. We have, of course, the astronomers, and we have the great staff here, and we have the director, but we also have a board of trustees and a science steering committee. And the chief scientist is really supposed to be kind of an interface between all those to help articulate and form and work together to build a science policy for the observatory and to really respond to changes in trends in astronomy to make sure that the observatory has the type of instrumentation that we need, that we're doing the cutting-edge astronomy that we've always been doing for 25 years, but to jump on the really new emerging trends in astronomy that are super exciting. And we want to maintain our leadership, and the role of the chief scientist is to really just be part of the community and help hone that message and work together towards a common goal.
A lot of people in Hawaii might sort of take it for granted that there is a lot of cutting edge leading science in the field of astronomy happening here. Could you give us just a brief overview of what type of work is being done at Keck right now?
Oh, sure. I mean, Keck impacts almost every level of astronomy. You can think about the solar system, where Keck plus adaptive optics has been doing wonderful things in the solar system, looking at moons of Jupiter and moons of Saturn and Neptune and Uranus. And then when you get farther out in astronomy, Keck is working on some really exciting things about very, very, very early stars in the universe, trying to think about some of the first stars in the universe, but also thinking about stars in our solar system in our galaxy that may have planets around them. Keck has been a consistent leader in the search for planets around other stars, and we're working on new types of instrumentation to measure that much more precisely and push it forward towards, you know, a goal of finding maybe an Earth-like planet around a Sun-like star. That's one of the big ideas that we're trying to work on in astronomy today. And then when you think about galaxies and how they work together, we've got exciting new instrumentation and instrumentation under development to really go deep down inside of galaxies, understand their black holes in the center, understand how galaxies form, understand how galaxies change over time. We don't understand that very well. And Keck has really been a major part of that story for many decades. And looking forward, we're just going to be looking at higher resolution and deeper dives to understand really at a fundamental level how they work. And that's really exciting territory. And I think the most, you know, the newest thing coming along is the area of transient astronomy and multi-messenger astronomy. So explosions of supernovae or colliding neutron stars that make powerful explosions out there in the universe, but only emit for a very brief period of time. So you have to have an observatory that can be there very, very quick to respond and catch that light before it fades away. And we're creating new plans to be able to do that, especially as, you know, gravitational wave observatories find more things and as we find more supernovae events and as survey telescopes find more and more exciting things to point at.
John, how important is Keck's physical location here in Hawaii to the work that you're doing?
Oh, the site on Mauna Kea is absolutely critical to do world-class astronomy. Mauna Kea is, of course, very high up, about 13,700 feet up at the summit, and because of that, there's a lot less atmosphere, which is, you know, bad for human beings, but great for astronomy. It means you have a lot less blurring effects of light, and being kind of close to the equator, so you can see a significant part of the sky, and being that high up, it's one of the best places in the world.
And John, it sounds like a big part of your new position will be communicating, whether with staff at Keck or with the public or leaders in the community. And we always hear that communication is a big challenge for many scientists, communicating what their work is doing, the importance of it, how it can benefit the community. Is that a problem you've encountered in your professional career?
Oh, certainly. I think, you know, scientists love to get deep down into what they're doing research-wise and sometimes forget who pays for that, which is the public and just a lot of organizations and donors and various other things. So we need to be able to communicate what we do very well with all those folks. And so my job, fortunately, I can leverage sort of 10 years as an educator to be able to distill these things down into chunks that anybody can work with and communicate the science at all levels. And so I think that's a big part of my job, if not the most important part of my job, is to be able to reach out to all those parts of the community, work together with them, communicate the great science that we're doing, and figure out how to work together to do even better science going forward.
Well, while we have you here, then, what's your elevator pitch for astronomy and maybe specifically for astronomy in Hawaii?
I think, you know, my elevator pitch for Hawaii is that there's no place better in the world to do blue wavelength astronomy and to do really dark sky astronomy. And there's no better place for that than Mauna Kea. And having all these telescopes up there working really hard, working together, brings great science to the world, and then we have to spread that science out. And so Keck has been a leader in that. I've been really happy to be a part of that community for two decades now, and I'm really excited to bring us to, you know, these new exciting eras in science and continue to change the world with sharing our common sky.
John, it seems like in more recent history, science has become a lot more political than it used to be. And I wonder if that's something you've encountered in your work life, and just how do you view the relationship between science and politics and scientists and politics and how they have influenced each other in recent years?
Yeah, we would love to be in a world where science wasn't political, but that's not reality. All aspects of things in everyday life and certainly in science life have an aspect of politics to them. At the end of the day, many of our instruments are funded by national agencies, or many of the grants that fund astronomers are funded by national agencies, which means it's part of the national dialogue, and the national dialogue is politics at local level, at federal level, at all these levels. And so politics may not, you know, science and the sky is not a Democrat versus Republican issue, but it is part of the political discussion because, you know, at the end of the day, we have to decide how we value things, how we pay for things, and how we want to do things going forward. So this goes back to your earlier question about communicating science. This is why it's so important for us to be good communicators of science, so that the public understands, you know, where their money's going and why we're doing great things, and to show them how exciting the sky can be.
And John, it seems like this is a real golden age for astronomy. There are constantly new discoveries being made. Do you have any hopes or predictions maybe for the next 10 or 20 years, new discoveries that might come either out of Keck or anywhere else in the world?
Oh, I think there's going to be some very exciting science coming in the next decades. The field of exoplanet exploration, characterization of exoplanets, finding them, understanding them is clearly going to be a big part of science going forward. And Keck's been a wonderful leader and is really looking forward towards the next generation of instruments and the next generation of science questions for those. So searching for life in the universe, but I think even larger than that, telling the story of life in the universe, not just finding planets and looking for biosignatures in their atmospheres, but understanding how the elements got there in the first place. That means understanding stars, understanding how the stars group together. That's understanding galaxies. And so putting that sort of as a collective goal out there for the next decade to be able to tell the story of life in the universe is going to be a really exciting thing for astronomy and a wonderful thing for Keck, because we're so well positioned to do that well, to continue to do that well, and to continue to lead.
All right, John O'Mara, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was the Keck Observatory's new chief scientist, John O'Mara, who came via St. Michael's College in Vermont, where he taught astronomy and physics. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you are with The Conversation.
There's a term in the social science world for people who stick their heads in the sand to avoid bad news. It's called the ostrich effect. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and believe it or not, some listeners turn into ostriches during membership campaigns. Now, we know that you'd never do that, but a close friend of yours, they might. Catch my drift? Set a good example for that friend and make a year-end gift now.
Heads up, new members welcome at HPR. Donate online, and thanks.
For the Backyard Quiz today, we asked you why you can't look through the eyepieces of the world's largest reflector telescopes. These are the mighty twins of the Keck Observatory. Each has 36 precisely polished segments, and each has a light-gathering surface 10 meters in diameter. The Keck telescopes had the largest mirrors in the world and perched atop Mauna Kea's 13,796-foot summit. They produced the most breathtaking close-ups of the universe ever seen from Earth. Why then, why can't we look through the eyepieces? Well, it's because the telescopes don't have any eyepieces. Instead, they have over a dozen highly sophisticated photon-detecting instruments that analyze all the data the mirrors gather and then relay it to computer monitors, which may, of course, be printed out and looked at any time you wish. And those pictures are, to paraphrase Carl Sagan, worth billions and billions of words. And congratulations to a gentleman named Hub. He called in while he was driving very slowly over the Pulley. He shared a personal connection to the Keck telescopes. He actually worked on the coding systems of the equipment up there. You're the winner. Thanks a lot, Hub, for calling in. That's today's quiz. And if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It was a novel idea proposed 45 years ago by then Honolulu Mayor Frank Fossey. We're talking about neighborhood boards, a structure spanning 33 districts across Oahu. The Neighborhood Commission Office is preparing for elections that take place next spring, and it's beating the bushes looking for candidates interested in improving life where they live. The signups began yesterday, and they run through February 15th. Executive Director Sean Hamamoto tells us more.
You know, a few years back when I just started this position, I did do some research trying to see what other cities were doing. And to my surprise, I really found less than a handful of such grassroots neighborhood organizations, you know, across the country. You know, I think I found one in Seattle, maybe one in Michigan, but it's not common. That's what I'm trying to say. It's very special. I think we're very fortunate to have this in the city and county of Honolulu. A platform where the community can, you know, face-to-face address their elected officials and other government agencies to really find out, you know, get to the core of what's going on in our communities, really at the grassroots level.
It's really about access.
Absolutely. And that's one thing we've improved upon over the years is, I would say over the last decade, the trend has been more and more neighborhood boards are actually becoming televised. Which is, you know, I'm a former neighborhood board member, too. I was a board member for the Downtown Neighborhood Board. And while I was there, that was actually one of my initiatives is to get that board televised because there we had our monthly meetings and, you know, there was no parking, maybe sometimes, you know, just for maybe elderly residents or whatnot. My idea was, hey, this is a communities board. It should be accessible to everybody and not just anyone who can happen to make it in person. So I want to say out of our 33 boards, I want to say at least 28 or 29 are being recorded at this time.
And then do you stream them on the internet?
So we don't have live streaming capability yet, but we do contract with a videographer. And what they do is they'll tape it. They'll bring it to Olelo. Olelo will replay it maybe a week or so later. And also they'll put it online in their archives. So if you want to go back and see what happened at the Kailua Neighborhood Board in 2008 in February, you could look that up.
And let's talk about how important this model is because it's getting some attention across the country and internationally.
Just this past year, we received an inquiry from a municipality in Canada who had heard about us. And also we had an intern coming to us from the Ukraine all the way in Europe. Interestingly, her internship was with the Office of Economic Development, but she just had heard about this neighborhood board system. So she made some requests to come visit our office, and I was happy to have her. I guess the Ukraine right now, you know, they're going through some transitions in their government, moving towards more of a democratic system. And this intern just thought our neighborhood board system was just wonderful. So she wanted to learn more, and she thought that this system could work great in the Ukraine. I believe she was even interviewed in Civil Beat, and she even made mention about one of the things that stood out to her was our neighborhood board system we have here.
So I recall this was started under then Mayor Frank Fossey.
Correct. Yes.
And it's really kind of morphed. I attended a forum, I think, in Palolo Valley, where they just focused on the monster home issue, something
yes.
important to that community. And they gathered people to really talk about what was happening and what could be done about it.
Correct. And, you know, a lot of, I would say in many instances, solutions to a lot of our community's issues come from the neighborhood boards. And I can say, you know, talking to a lot of council members, they're very appreciative that these issues can be addressed at the grassroots level in the community, you know, before, you know, coming full-blown to the full council and such. So, you know, another good example of how these neighborhood boards work is there was an issue earlier this year about Alexander and Baldwin buying Manoa Marketplace. And one of their plans was controversial because they were going to cut down the trees in the parking lot, the beloved trees. So this issue got brought to the Manoa Neighborhood Board, and just working collaboratively, civilly, you know, with all the parties involved, government, Alexander and Baldwin, the community, they came up with a solution to redesign the parking lot and save the trees. So it was a win-win. And again, this all took place at the neighborhood board level. So this is a great win for the community.
So we need people to participate.
Yes, Catherine, yes, and that's why I'm here. So we are accepting candidates now for the next 2 months. And also we want to let your listeners, if they want to get more information about this, we are starting a mobile text platform. And, of course, standard messaging rates will apply. But if your listeners want to type or text GONCO, that's GONCO, text GONCO to the number 95577, and you'll get real-time updates from our office. And one thing we're trying to use technology even more now, on the first time we're implementing it this year, is now people will have the ability to register as a candidate from their mobile device. You know, before they would have to request a form or download it and mail it in, but now they can do it right from their phones, and we can save some paper and some postage too.
I know there are a number of folks that have joined just because of a particular issue, got involved, and then it turned into a career in politics.
You know, some of our, that's a great point, Catherine. You know, some of our well-known politicians have come from the neighborhood board system. I think just in this recent election, I believe we had three, Representative Del Kobayashi. He was the chair of the Manoa Neighborhood Board. We have newly elected Senator Kurt Favela, and he was part of our Eva Beach Neighborhood Board. And there was Representative Okimoto from... So I know we had three people that got their starts from the neighborhood boards, grassroots level, and, you know, made it up to higher levels. And even prior to this year, just off the top of my head, Representative Cedric Gates, former neighborhood board member and chair, Senator Carl Rhodes, even our Mayor Kirk Caldwell was a former board member. So, yes, this is a great place for those... interested in perhaps a political career, this is a great platform because you really learn the community's issues, you know, at its most basic level.
Right, and I recall Willis Sparrow, he was on, I think he had your job.
Actually, yes, he
when.
Was my predecessor, yes. Big shoes to fill. I like Will very much.
So really, it's a way to be able to cut your teeth on the process, learn and get involved if you really care about what's going on in your community.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a very inclusive system. To be eligible for a candidate, you just need to be 18 years old and a resident. That's it. We do have certain specific areas where it has been a struggle to get candidates.
Tell us about the elections, because they're done online. Folks are really the guinea pigs. You've been testing this out.
Yes. Overall, it's been going well. You know, this online elections first started in 2009, so it's been about a decade. I can say that since it's first started online, it's been increasing. I think the first year we went online, we had about maybe 10,000 voters. 2 years ago, our most recent election, we had 20,000. So we're hoping to see that trend continue. Basically, people who voted in the most recent general election are automatically registered. So they'll be receiving ballots in contested races. We don't send out ballots if they're uncontested. But for those people who for some reason didn't vote in the general election but still want to vote in the neighborhood board elections, they can still register to vote by contacting our office. Best way to reach us is our number, 768-3710. That's our direct line.
Now, when you made the transition from paper ballots to online, you mentioned there was a drop in participation.
Yes, there was.
People are not used to it.
Yeah, and that's what we find. You know, there is a learning curve. Ballots has been, I guess, traditionally, that's the way it's been done in America. But so this online was new. So there was some hesitation, some apprehension about the use of this technology. But I just think as we move on and technology improves, people will become more comfortable. And what I found, it was maybe those citizens who weren't quite used to the technology, so perhaps senior citizens, that they were the most apprehensive. But we did want to make it accessible. So we do work with our state library system. So if people don't have their own computer at home, they can go to any state library system and use their computers. We want to make Hawaii a model for online voting is, you know, where we're going, as we do really think that's, you know, where the future is taking us. So, yeah, you know, it's very exciting, and we just hope to get more participation than ever. In our last election, we had 611 candidates. That was the second most of all time on record. So that was a good statistic. So we're hoping to get more than that this year.
Are there any areas, any particular neighborhoods where you just know you've had problems getting people to step up to the plate?
Just off the top of my head, I know there's some like maybe pockets like in, say, Kahala, a certain sub-district there. But, you know, at the end of the day, we just want everybody to get out. We are making more of a concerted effort this year to get out in the community. We're going to be making about a dozen stops around our island, just stopping at various shopping centers, places, just to inform people about the neighborhood boards and try to get them to sign up to be candidates.
Kind of a pop-up thing.
Yes, yeah. So we're working with a lot of the shopping malls, you know, around the island. They've been very helpful.
Sean Hamamoto is the executive director of the Neighborhood Commission Office. For links to this story, check our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. That is it for today. Up tomorrow, we talk bike sharing, navigating around Beaky and Sherry. Tell us what's on your mind. Have you had a good or bad experience on the bikes? Call our talkback line. Leave us a comment. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.